Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show number 164. Big Web Show's Everything Web That Matters. And today, rustling in the background, is my good friend and our today's guest, Tontik Celik. Let me say a little bit about Tontik. I could really spend the whole hour just talking about what he's done, but I will keep it brief. He's a Turkish-American computer scientist, the web standards lead at Mozilla Corporation, and he was previously the chief technologist at Technorati. He worked on microformats and is one of the principal editors of several cascading style sheets specifications. Tontik is also the author of a book, HTML5 Now, a video. HTML5 Now, a step-by-step video tutorial for getting started today. He is known for such things as Internet Explorer 5 for Mac, the Tasman layout engine, which was the first rendering engine to do a good job of trying to properly parse as much of CSS as possible. He was the creator of the box model hack, which allowed us to create layouts when Internet Explorer and other browsers had different interpretations for how to handle padding. He's just a force of nature. You created microformats with Matt Mullenweg of Automattic and Eric Meyer of An Emetta Part. Is that correct?
We, the three of us, created XFN, the XHTML Friends Network.
Right, which was the
back
first
in 2003.
Okay,
that was the first microformat before we even called them microformats. But I created microformats the next year as an overarching effort with Kevin Marks.
And the concept, it wasn't just a nerdy little hobby. The concept was, instead of waiting for these giant, profound, complex standards to come from above, what if we grassroots, since HTML is extensible by nature, what if we just make these different simple HTML extension languages, which we can then train our browsers to interpret? Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's a reasonable summary. In many ways, the grass was already growing, as it were, when Kevin Marks and I showed up to declare this to be a pattern. Web designers had already started using semantic class names, like in their modern HTML and CSS websites. And we noticed that there was a lot of patterns there that we could say, hey, if we decided to use the same class names, then we could actually interchange more information, like about people and events and reviews. And microformats is the community and the process of formalizing those kinds of design patterns, as it were, markup patterns that came from the modern web design community.
How did the web standards establishment respond to this idea? Or did they?
I suppose perhaps the best summary of the web standards establishment response was not too dissimilar from the response that Tim got from his original proposal.
Okay.
In that
interesting.
But interesting.
Yeah.
A little informal, but interesting. But that didn't really bother us so much because it was a grassroots effort. So we didn't really need formal approval, as it were. Our audience was the folks actually building the web,
right?
Professionals, web designers, web developers. And for them, what we'd essentially done is take the patterns that they had already built into their workflow and just give them a vocabulary to use in those patterns.
Now, in the slightly earlier 2000s, Andy Clark and Doug Bowman had gone through the web, noticing that several of us used similar semantic class names and suggesting that perhaps all designers could standardize on a few semantic class names, like, this is an aside, or a lot of people call this a footer. Maybe that's what we should all call it, that kind of thing, which was in the air when you came up with microformats. And a little while later, that same thinking was used by Ian Hixon as sort of the basis of HTML5, right? Which was a big departure, saying, let's look at what developers do. Let's codify it. Let's put it into HTML, and then everybody will do it. Is that fair? And how do you, if so, how do you feel about your influence on HTML5?
I think that's very fair. Ian did a lot of really good work with surveying, I think it was like, I want to say 2004, 2005 timeframe, what the markup patterns were like on the web at the time, in particular with rel attributes, and I think with class names as well. And as you observed, like the structure of a page, like sort of like the top level, oh, this is a header, these are the asides or gutters, or this is a footer. And out of that came a handful of the new HTML5 elements, which I think have had moderate success.
You're joking.
That's been...
Right, okay. You're just very dry, so I just wanted to make sure the audience knew that you were joking. Okay. Yes, it's been very successful, in part because he had the power of Google behind him.
At the time, he was at Opera.
Interesting.
Interestingly enough. Yeah, he didn't join Google until years later. And I do think that HTML5 succeeded, and Ian's editorship of it succeeded, not because he was in any particular company, but because he had already done a lot of real hard work up to that point, like sort of across the web platform, with everything from, say, CSS, you know, test cases, to he'd written several tools that people used to mock up various things. Like we have things like JSBin today, but back then when we needed a tool like that, or Ian needed a tool, he would just build it himself.
Right.
On his like hixi.ch domain. And he basically had done enough work to command the respect of his peers.
Right.
Which so, I do. Yeah. I think that's a better way of looking at of people and influence than say who works for what company.
I totally agree with you. And if I inadvertently slighted him through my ignorance, I apologize. I totally agree. I think there's two things worth calling out here. One is that, yes, he had street cred because he'd done a bunch of stuff. But the other thing is he approached the design, the further design of HTML, the redesign of HTML, the way a good designer approaches a design project, which is learn the user, study the user, learn their pain points, discover why they're doing what they're doing, figure out what paths they use and why they use them, and then make a product that helps them do more, even better, but accords with the way they're thinking. So he learned his user's mental model. He didn't assume that he knew it, right? Even though he probably did have great insight into it, he didn't assume that he knew the way other people did semantic markup. He looked at a lot of stuff. So he basically did research and then presented a design after having done a lot of research. And I think that's another reason it succeeded. And given the chronology you've just told me, Google, who are not stupid, then went, oh, we should hire this person because look what they just did. They just did something really smart and they just made something really smart. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
Yeah. And is he still there?
I think he's still at Google. I'm not sure what he's working on today. But I do know that he stepped back from day-to-day editing of HTML a little while ago, and that's currently being done by Anna von Kestren, who has also been a longstanding contributor to web standards and the web platform.
Right. Now, you have worked at big companies yourself. Apple.
I have.
Apple, Microsoft, Oracle, Sun, now you're at Mozilla, which is more of a rebel, and I would assume much less corporately structured than these other organizations. How did your career start? How did you discover and fall in love with the web and all that? Your family, Turkish American? Are you second generation, first generation?
I'm first generation.
Okay, so you're first generation and have two...
I'm a California native, as it were.
Okay. You're born in California. You went to Stanford and studied computer science.
I did. And coming from a lower middle class background, there was certainly none of the shenanigans that have been reported recently.
Oh, I don't even know about those. I missed those.
Oh, it's there's a whole big the FBI bust of apparently a lot of bribery was going on by very, very well off families.
That I'm aware of. I didn't know it affected Stanford, but no. That's been a big story with the celebrities in the Dragnet and all that.
But
you didn't get in for that reason. You don't have a super wealthy celebrity family who bribed someone. You got in because you're a very, very smart person and hardworking. And so how did
you picked up plenty of loans as a result? Yep. So that's how that goes.
I think Apple was your first real job or your first like computing job, or is that not true?
That's not totally true. It depends on like when we're going to count from. My first real kind of computing job was a summer internship for NASA JPL.
Wow.
In Pasadena. Okay. And that was kind of like an amazing dream, as you can imagine, for like a teenager. Just like work at the place where they write software to control spaceships and probes. Yeah. I mean, it sounds almost like sci-fi just saying it, but that's literally what they do.
Not every teenager's dream, but let's say a certain kind of very smart teen's dream. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that was during high school?
That was, yes.
And then you were, you went to Stanford. And what after Stanford, what did you do?
So after Stanford, or at Stanford, is when I did a brief stint doing tech support, telephone tech support for Sun, and then which I highly recommend that anyone that wants to be a developer or design new platforms do, and that's like actually talk to real developers on the phone and get a impression of what frustrates them and what troubles them, because it will help you build empathy faster than almost anything else you could do.
And also learn the product very fast. I'm just started as a creative director at Automattic, who are the makers of WordPress and other products. And the first thing they have every employee do at whatever level, no matter what job they're eventually going to do, the first thing they do is a happiness engineer, which is what they call their customer support folks. And you spend all day talking to people who are frustrated who are confused at all levels of knowledge, right? At all, you know, there's like experienced and, you know, there's business people, there's longtime bloggers, there's newcomers. There's, I had a gentleman, didn't understand why he couldn't change his headline. And, he hadn't actually structured it as a headline or anything. It was just words that he typed into a form field.
Well, so he's not wrong.
No, that's the point. You just, all the assumptions that you have after 20, 25 years of working on the web, you think, well, everybody knows X, Y, and Z. They don't. And so you get a real wonderful education into the many kinds of users, many kinds of customers that are out there, and what their different needs are. And you're sort of learning the product and what it does and doesn't do at the same time that you're helping people in this sort of hands-on level. I also think if you're going to be a chef, you should wash dishes for 2 weeks. You know, that doesn't introduce you to the customer, but I do think service is a really good prerequisite for any kind of customer service or any kind of job where you're inventing things that people are going to use.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the folks at Mule Design, Erica Hall and Mike Montero and their employees?
I do know Erica and Mike, and I've known them for many years, and I'm kind of grateful that they've stuck around, because they've been around since the 90s in the web, and that's quite a long time at this point.
It is, and running an agency all those years is very challenging. And yeah, but the point I wanted to make is that they have a rule that they won't hire a designer who hasn't worked in a restaurant or some other kind of service job.
Well, that would disqualify me, I think. I don't think I've ever worked in a restaurant.
No, but you did customer support at Sun, so that yes. qualifies you.
Yeah, and in particular, phone support. That's the piece I wanted to emphasize, because it's one thing to get like a ticket on some online system and you essentially have like a bunch of text or an email that you're like, oh, I'll just respond to this person's email. And it's all very kind of detached from the humanity of it. But when you talk to someone on the phone, you really can tell, like, hey, this is a real human being. They've got feelings. They're clearly under some sort of pressure for something, and they are stuck, and they're feeling vulnerable, and they need help. Which a lot of that just doesn't come through if all you do is online support, like electronic mail or, you know, some ticketing system. So I would emphasize that too. Like, if there's some way to like actually talk to the folks that you're getting support from. I mean,
yeah, totally agree. Again, that's recommended design research, right? Before beginning a design project, actually talk to the customer whenever you can. It's another form of the same knowledge that, you know, if you really want to build empathy, find out who you're making stuff for and learn what their lives are like. Are we doing a good job of that now as an industry? Would you say in terms of the products tech makes or the standards community, whichever way you want to take this? It's kind of a big open question.
There's so much there to unpack.
I know. I know, but just pick something.
Let's talk about standards, because I think that's an area that's close to both of our hearts. I think that in many areas of standards, we are in touch with web developer like pain points and needs and in-person communication and conversations. And I also think in many areas of standards that that's still not necessarily the case as well.
We're not in XHTML. For those who weren't around at the time, like, there, we had XHTML2 for a while as a proposal, which was so detached from what developers actually did that it said, yeah, everything is going to break, but it's going to be done the right way this time. We're starting over. Like, the web was sort of an experiment. It had been done wrong, and that 10, 12, 15 years of websites were going to be thrown away, and browsers were going to have to be recreated from scratch so that a more pure form of markup. I have to tell you, if you type or anything,
it comes through.
Yeah, it's really super loud, so we have to try not to do that on the show. I'm sorry.
I was trying to do some research for you while you were talking.
I know. I'm sure you were. Do you remember XHTML? We're just talking.
I do, and I was literally, this was about that, because there's a, you said web developers, like talk to web developers, and I do think that's an area that's like such a broad term.
Right. Oh yeah, for sure.
In particular, I believe you need to talk to professional web developers who are depending on doing this work for a living, and so they're particularly motivated to make their workflow efficient and to be able to service their clients or whatever work.
If we go,
in contrast to, like, say, hobbyists, right? Nothing wrong with hobbyists. Like, in many ways, I consider myself a web hobbyist. I don't professionally produce web pages. I do make web pages for my own site. But that only affords me like a tiny amount of understanding in terms of the actual pressures of what a professional web developer experiences.
I do think this is a very important point. I think that, how can I put this? So there's an ideal, like, famous young web designer developer who's really expert and has written books and gets to reinvent their job and everything. And that's like one in a billion people. But most of the web, you have a boss in a product company. You have a boss who's basically rewarding you for how much stuff you make, not how good is it, how much does it satisfy the customer. Have you taken something that was, you know, B- and made it A+? No, that's not what gets rewarded. What gets rewarded is you got a lot of stuff done without spending a lot of money. You got it done real fast. And so the pressure, the tremendous pressure that front-end developers, back-end developers, hybrids, full stack, whatever different people call them, whatever their different skill areas are, they're under tremendous pressure to get a lot done in a limited time frame. And as a result, they go to tools where, I mean, we can look at, you know, Bootstrap and sort of its many progeny. And we can look at all the JavaScript stuff that I think you and I have mixed feelings about. But the the tool sets that are out there, in part, are there because people need to get work done incredibly fast. And we're probably not going to change capitalism. And we're probably not going to change the business model of other people's companies. So if people need to get stuff done real fast, and they can do it real fast by plugging a bunch of tool chains together, but perhaps the product isn't particularly accessible or particularly performant because these tools weren't made, they're not bespoke tools that were made for this particular project. They're big, powerful tools. I like the analogy I use is, if you had to use Microsoft Office to send a text message, you could do it, but it would be a very heavy text message because it would have spell checkers and all this other stuff that the text doesn't actually need, you know, word art and stuff. I think that's,
and now our text, the irony is our text messages now have spell checkers.
Well, that's true too.
And like animated GIFs and,
but the text doesn't, like, the text doesn't have the spell checker. I guess, you know, you're right. So maybe it's a terrible analogy. It would have been a great analogy 4 years ago. But I guess my point, now that we have much more powerful phones, it's a poor analogy. But my point is, and I think this is the point you were driving toward too, the standards community hasn't necessarily addressed all the pain points. So people are using these tools. It's one reason anyway that people are using these complex tool sets. And I think we have people talking past each other now. And these rifts in our community where you get this group of people saying CSS doesn't scale, or CSS scales, but it's too hard, or it doesn't scale and it's too hard, or it's too hard and it's not a computing language, like really incomprehension towards CSS. And then the people on our side, I'll say, like the more traditional semantic web type people, are sort of going, why are you using that? You're being lazy. That's not fair to your user. And I don't think we're hearing each other. And I don't know what we should do about this.
Well, this has happened before.
Okay.
Which, of course, you will remember as soon as I tell you.
Flash?
Which is when I didn't have to tell you. You knew it. Flash was an incredibly productive tool chain. For a whole segment of developers that were required to get things done as fast as possible that worked cross-browser.
And it had to be as flashy as possible. Also,
right.
Like, it couldn't, like the idea that, you know, if you're painstaking and you really master all the inadequacies of in different browsers towards CSS, then you can make a fairly plain-looking page where you have some nice typographic control. And they're going, no, I work for an entertainment company, and this has to be very, you know, it's got to move and dance. And I remember feeling, I had friends who were designers, like who started their agencies same time I did mine, and their work was winning all the awards because it was dazzling. And I remember thinking, am I a fool to keep pushing for HTML? Because it just seemed ridiculous that I was making these sites that were kind of attractive when other people were making basically graphic design that moved.
Long before we had CSS animations.
Right. In a way, Flash was a great way of letting us know, what do we want to build someday when we have standard means of doing so? Like, how should animation work? Like, a lot of people cut their teeth on Flash animation, then went into, you know, then when it went away, they were sort of dissatisfied. And now some of them, again, can be really adept at making beautiful interaction, hopefully interactive animations that help users understand what's happening, not just movement for its own sake. Always something that helps comprehension.
Yes, hopefully that's the primary function that they're doing. There's also been incredible CSS art that's been produced that blows my mind.
Right, the woman who makes these like 18th century paintings, but they're entirely, although I, you know, I'm sure the markup isn't, that's not the CSSN garden. That's not, if you changed her CSS, you'd find that she'd got the Declaration of Independence in there. That's just a whole bunch of crazy spans on spans on spans on divs on spans. I'm sure would have to be, right? A lot of
it's a different kind of medium, as it were.
It's a way of saying, wow, this technology really can do anything. But why do you think so many people are resisting CSS grid, are resisting semantic markup? I still, you know, 15 years from the time that Steve Champion talked about progressive enhancement, we still have people saying, I don't think it's necessary anymore, or it doesn't matter, or why is there so much? Why I've had clients who were getting sued over their inaccessibility, and yet we still had to have a conversation about whether we could make something accessible for them, you know, when to me that was a given. And it was like, you're already being sued over this. Like, why would you not? And yet it's just not a what's going on? Why, again, why is there this incomprehension, this mismatch between what folks like you and me think every website should be able to do and what a lot of other people think and the practice?
Outright cognitive dissonance from what you're saying. Like, if they're being sued on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're not addressing it as a need. That feels pretty ironic.
Unless it's like when the Pinto was exploding and Ford said, gee, retooling this is going to cost us $5 billion. Letting people die and then paying off the survivors is only going to cost us $500 million, so let's do that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that would be sad if that's the kind of math that they're doing.
Go ahead.
I believe that there is a challenge here of and you alluded to it as far as like the folks that work for either inside companies or for agencies of a huge time pressure to deliver.
Right.
And then on top of that, as you pointed out with Flash, there's pressure to deliver a different level of experience, of interactive experience, let's say, that is targeted at, you know, the most abled users. And those pressures inevitably drive the creation of these tool chains, which are catered to those needs. Like, it's not like we can pretend that those needs don't exist. They do exist because there's some manager somewhere who's got a budget that he needs to meet or she needs to meet to be able to deliver some website for one of their customers, whether it's an internal customer or an external customer. And if they don't do it, then that customer goes to someone else, or the pressure is on the individual web developer. If they don't do it, then someone else gets the job.
These pressures aren't
going away. Like, we need to accept that this is the part of the kind of the production world that we live in, and that all our tools live in. And I feel like where some of these standards-based approaches need to kind of step up their game is the productivity aspect of when you're building with the standards and you're building accessibly and you're building with progressive enhancement. We need to always be making that more efficient for the builder.
More time efficient.
Like, it doesn't matter that, like, you could do it. Like, there's one thing in like, oh, hey, here's a technique. And now if you spend X amount of time, you can carry out this technique and your website is progressively enhanced or your website is accessible. Great. That was last year. This year, you need to be able to do that faster, right? There needs to be tooling set up to generate the necessary markup or the necessary style sheets or the necessary templates to do all that faster. Like, this has been happening for a while. We know this. There's all the style sheet, like, I'm not even sure framework is the right word for it, but things like Less and Sass, we're clearly addressing a need from web developers faster than the CSS working group could.
Right. And some of those things filtered back into the CSS standards.
Right.
But I think in a way you're almost making the case, and my friend Jen Simmons would probably dislike my saying this, but it, Jen's take on, like, now we have CSS Grid is great. Now we can be really innovative in our layouts and not just make everything look like Bootstrap. And right. She's right. But also, given that there are people who have incredible time performance demands on them, I wonder if it wouldn't be a good public service for someone to make, like, lean semantic modules in a simple pattern library where everything was accessible, progressively enhanced. The layout modules all worked in CSS Grid. It was fast. It loaded fast. It worked everywhere except, like, old versions of IE, and you have a little, you know, and we all know there's things you do to take care of the old version of IE, so that's okay. And if you basically made a standards compliant, super fast, fast loading, accessible Bootstrap, not Bootstrap, but you know, a tool like that, it might be a good public service, a good way to get adoption and move past some of the, I mean, some of yeah. this is some
you
of
you said it,
it
yeah. a pattern library of markup and style.
The trouble is some people are learning only on JavaScript tool chains, and they actually think they haven't learned that, like, a button can be a button. They think a button should be a div with a bunch of JavaScript applied to it. They don't. Do you know what I mean?
And we used to have people that only learned on Flash tool chains.
Right. So you're saying this is solvable. But
somehow we did solve that. And it wasn't just because Steve Jobs said no Flash on the iPhone. Although, I mean, we can't understate the impact of that.
Huge.
But that being said, like, we definitely, everything back to the Web Standards Project and fighting for interoperable, usable standards across browsers, like, we made it happen. And we need to acknowledge that there are folks that are, you know, stuck in a particular tool chain for whatever reason. That doesn't mean that they personify with it. Maybe if they're the creator of the tool chain. But we need to assume that what they really want is to just get their jobs done.
Right. Right. Well, I think the assumption that people who disagree are evil is one of the great problems in our time, and that we shouldn't.
Yeah, that's...
And we shouldn't.
Way to take it up a level.
Okay. And we, that may be in our, we may be stuck with that in our politics for a while, but we probably don't have to bring that into how we develop websites. Maybe
we could, we don't.
Maybe. Okay.
That's right.
I'm going to take a quick commercial break. So hang in there, and then we're going to come right back to more talk about standards and problems and, man.
And what can we do next?
Yeah. Let me take this quick commercial break, though. This episode of The Big Web Show is brought to you by Blockstack. There is a better version of the internet, and it's already here. It's a decentralized one, free from data breaches and privacy abuses, where you own your identity and data. Blockstack is, you know, there's a weird noise coming from you, Tantik. It sounds like you're doing a Darth Vader breathing impression into some kind of weird space tunnel, or are you wearing like a plastic body suit and something?
No, let me mute though.
Okay, that's great. You mute and I'm going to try this again. Okay, thanks very much. So this episode of The Big Web Show is brought to you by Blockstack. All right. There's a better version of the internet, and it's already here. It's a decentralized one, free from data breaches and privacy abuses, where you own your identity and your data. Blockstack is an open computing protocol that makes it easy for developers to build applications which guarantee their users' digital rights. Blockstack provides a stack of important layers developers can use so that people who use their apps truly own their data, own their identity, and even their content and connections. These decentralized applications are more secure than traditional options, and with Blockstack, you make no sacrifices on performance or scalability. The blockchain-backed Blockstack ID. That is a fun thing to say. The blockchain-backed blocks. The blockchain. stays mainly on the plane. The blockchain-backed Blockstack ID allows users to safely and seamlessly engage with these applications and take back their online lives from data-hungry corporate giants. No names, please. Blockstack is open source and it's free. Learning to build the future of the internet takes less than 60 minutes. And starting to use one of the many apps with your Blockstack ID takes just a few minutes. Developers, you can even get paid to build better applications using Blockstack via the app mining program. So, it's time to take back our digital rights. The Blockstack ecosystem is hard at work, and we'd love to have you learn more and get started at blockstack.org/bigwebshow. That's blockstack.org/bigwebshow. This episode of the Big Web Show also comes to you care of Robinhood. Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free. While other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, Robinhood doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can trade stocks and keep all your profits. Plus, there's no minimum account deposit needed to get started, so you can start investing at any level. The simple, intuitive design of Robinhood makes investing easy for newcomers and experts alike. View easy-to-understand charts and market data and place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. You can also view stock collections, such as 100 most popular. With Robinhood, you can learn how to invest in the market as you build your portfolio, discover new stocks, track your favorite companies, and get custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest. And Robinhood is giving listeners of the Big Web Show a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help you build your portfolio. Sign up at bigwebshow.robinhood.com. That's bigwebshow.robinhood.com. And now back to episode 186 and today's guest, Tontic Chelik. Okay, Tontic, we are back and you can unmute. I think I introduced this show as episode 164. It's actually 186, so that's crazy. Now I feel
that
like
is
I, have
crazy.
I have to check again. It is 186, so okay, that's going to be fun. We can't clean up anything in editing. I mean, we could, but we're just going to let the error roll. That's how we roll. This is a real show, and I make
this is 186?
This is 186, yeah.
Yeah. Did you first show 182? Did you talk about the blink tag?
Blink 182? That's funny. Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Couldn't help it.
182 was It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work with Jason Fried. 183 was Open Source Google and WordPress 5.0 with Matt Mullenweg. 184 was Accessibility is Not a Nice to Have with Derek Featherstone, and 185 was Design as a Relationship Business with Joe Rinaldi. You are my last man in this run of men that I'm doing, and then it's going to be women, 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 women. I don't know, as just an experiment. For a while I was doing like boy, girl, boy, girl. It just, I don't know why. And just the last run of people I wanted to talk to all were guys. So the next run that I'm already setting up are all women, and they are awesome, and you are awesome, my friend. I feel like you don't seem to care about this and about credit, but you are like totally an unsung hero of web standards and web standards based design and web design, starting with the Tasman rendering engine. Those, you made those beautiful favelets. I don't know how many longtime listeners or longtime web developers might remember. You made like little applets that you could use with a browser really early. I don't know, where does all your creativity come from, and how are you using it now at Mozilla?
Oh, great questions. I think a lot of my creativity comes from finding a need. Okay. I think part of it also comes from like a good challenge. So we had, you mentioned Tasman that we built the new rendering engine that we built for IE5 Mac.
Was that named for the Tasmanian devil, by the way?
It was named for Tasman the Explorer.
Oh. Was that a Turkish explorer?
No, I don't. I think he was.
Please excuse my ignorance. I'm very sorry.
That's okay. I don't know Explorer Tasman's ethnic background. So I suppose we could look that up on the web, but then that would add a lot of typing noise to your podcast.
I can do it because I have a really... Is it Abel Tasman, the Dutch seafarer, explorer, and merchant, best known for his voyages of 1642 and 1644?
That's it. Yeah, there you go.
Well, there you go. Abel Tasman. So you named it after that because it was an explorer. Oh, because Internet Explorer. Oh, how clever. That's really
awesome. We thought we were being clever, at least.
You were. It took me 20 years to get the joke, but
That's okay.
That's okay. Okay.
Yeah, that was, and that one was one where it wasn't like our personal need. I mean, we were all just working on a web browser. What did we know? But rather, I had the good fortune of, before we started on Tasman, I was asked to work on CSS on the previous version of IE for the Mac, Internet Explorer 4 for the Mac. And in that work, I quickly discovered that, you know, standards are, in some cases, they're in pretty good shape. Like CSS1 was in pretty good shape in 1998.
And in some cases, 1996.
Yeah. Better shape in 1998 because we had some more tests and a growing test suite for it. But in 1998, CSS2 was kind of a mess, an inconsistent mess. Like the spec itself, in trying to implement it, I came up with lots of questions and problems that I found. Took it to the working group, and in many cases, they're like, well, we didn't see that, or, but it's already too late to fix it. I'm like, well, you can't actually implement this. And this was back in the day when standards could happen by just a bunch of people agreeing in a room.
Right.
Rather than today, where W3C, especially the CSS working group, there are multiple stages where there is a requirement to demonstrate that something can actually work, both in a browser and hopefully prototyping it in various different web designs so that we know, hey, this idea is actually going to work as we think it's going
to
work.
And to be fair to the early standards practitioners, we had to get to a more advanced stage so we could bake that requirement in, right? We couldn't have that requirement when so little of it was implemented. Like, how could you test a more complex version of CSS when you can't even get, you know, spacing of headlines right yet? It's like browsers had to come on board. People had to test. People had to start using it, right? You need people like Rachel Andrew out there doing stuff before you go, oh, okay, well, this, do you know what I mean?
Well, you needed the browsers to actually participate in the standards process at the same rate that they're implementing in their code. And that wasn't quite happening at that point in time. There was some browsers, like, you know, the folks at Opera were trying to push things forward, of course, because they hired Hokun Lee, co-inventor of CSS.
Right.
But even they had challenges with parts of CSS. Like, no one, when we showed up with IE Mac and we're like, okay, let's implement some CSS, no one had actually implemented all of CSS1.
Right.
Much less CSS2. Like, CSS2 was unimplementable as it was written. Like, the CSS2 recommendation, which has since been superseded by 2.1, which took a lot of work to do. But the lesson learned there is that, like, if you do a standard without proving it in process with implementations, you're not actually making a useful standard. You're just making an academic paper. Like, that's not a good idea. And you're kind of, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's kind of deceiving a bit to proclaim that you created the standard when you don't even know if it works.
And this is how you moved from being a browser, being an implementer in the browser, to being a creator of standards. I had asked, where does your creativity come from? You said solving problems. You saw the problem. These folks have made specs that they don't know how to implement, that nobody can. So maybe I can help there.
Yeah, that took a while. That was a big cultural shift that had to occur at W3C to really make the standards process more pragmatic, and therefore solve solve problems, solve real problems for developers rather than like academic problems, and then solve those problems in ways that the browsers could actually implement rather than the kind of wish list approach in the past.
Why do you think
that's a pretty big deal?
That's a huge deal, but why do you think they started in such an academic detached way and weren't talking to designers and developers?
Because those were their, I mean, it comes down to social network, right? Like, I think those are the people that they knew. And
okay.
But the culture of like, well, create a mailing list and whoever shows up to talk about it must be the right person to talk about it. And of course, right. Who's going to show up to a mailing list on standards, but folks that are doing research and, you know, academia and that kind of thing. And your average web designer doesn't even know that that mailing list exists.
Right.
Much less like, do I have time to argue with people on a mailing list about a standard that I can't use?
That's right. And that's still a problem. They're still using some very arcane. I'm not saying that this should all get solved on Twitter or right or on Slack or Basecamp, but it's still like, as far as I can tell, there's a whole lot of newsletter subscription and just really arcane. It's hard to say, oh, we're working together for the future of the web to make the web much greater than it already is. When you say, so now just please get your Windows 3.1 laptop out and subscribe to this mailing list. You know what I mean? It seems like there's a contradiction there.
There's a bit of a disconnect in the tools there. Yeah. I will just take a point. Take a moment to plug, you know, the latest community that I've worked on, indieweb.org, which we deliberately from the beginning, which was 2011, said no mailing lists. Like we were going to use the web. We're going to use our website. We were going to use our read-write website, the way websites were intended by the creator to create this community and to grow it. And yeah, we used chat on IRC as like an adjunct. But that part was strictly optional. Like we literally use the web to innovate on the web itself.
How knowledgeable do you have to be? Because I love the idea of IndieWeb and IndieWebCamp and all those things. But I don't know that the gentleman I was just mentioning who didn't know how to code his WordPress site is going to be able to get with this. I don't know that. I don't know that the average busy developer who's using complex tool chains is going to be able to get with this.
I would say that was true probably about 3 years ago.
Okay.
But since then, there's been a huge number of things that have been built and services that have been set up that help people get started on the indie web with no technical knowledge whatsoever. There's a great website called micro.blog that started as a Kickstarter. Manton Reese built it. And when you first look at it, you're like, oh, this looks like it's a subscription website. So in many ways, it's a microblogging site like Twitter.
Looks like Twitter, yes.
It looks and feels like Twitter, especially when it started. But the big difference is that there's no advertising and it's a subscription model. However, because of that, he has managed to innovate on that website and provide more and more services. So if you sign up there now, not only can you post tweets and photos and do all the normal social media-like things, you can also associate that with your own personal domain. So it's like...
Is that how you do tantic.com, where your tweets all show up? Like you seem to publish them first at tantic.com, mm-hmm. And then they go to Twitter somehow. I don't know. Again, this, and I've been doing this for 25 years and I don't know how you do that. So how?
Well, I did it the hard way because when I was building it, there were no tools to do it. And I'm still doing it the hard, like I've built a little bit of PHP on my site to do that. And it still works that way. Like I have some code that calls the Twitter API to do that.
But
micro.blog. Yeah. Other solutions do that for you if that's what you want to do.
Got it.
If you're a WordPress guy, there's a handful of indie web plugins that you install them and essentially flip a few switches, which as I understand it, WordPress users like to do, turn on and configure their plugins.
Yeah,
and that is, you can cross-post to your posts to Twitter as well. You can post your tweets on your own WordPress, and then the plugin will push them to Twitter for you. And not only that, but it'll pull back the responses. That's the real neat trick.
Yeah, that's what makes it Twitter. Right.
But it'll pull them back to your own website. Look at the permalink of your post on your own website, and all of a sudden, the entire conversation is there. And even if Twitter goes down, or when Twitter goes down, if Twitter goes away, you still have everything.
How much does micro.blog cost, the subscription model?
That I would have to actually check their website. I do remember it being fairly cheap.
Yeah, because you don't want to be an inclusive community, but accidentally price some people out who are just really struggling, right?
Yeah.
Why I created Macro Blog, Discovery Timeline. Okay, this is definitely something for listeners to explore. Register. Looks like you can just register. Oh, it's $5 a month after that. Okay.
Well, that sounds right.
Yeah. That's what most things are.
And it's right. for the value they provide and the continued innovation. The thing that they did is the really unique thing they did was when they launched with full indie web standard support for web mentions, for Micropub, for all of these indie web standards that are essentially the building blocks of the social web now.
Right.
And by doing that, out of the box, anyone that has a micro.blog account can interact with other people with websites. It's not like I have to be on micro.blog to interact with micro.blog. It's like, oh, that's just one more way to set up a social presence on the web, and I can interact with other people with their websites on the web.
This is super cool. Do you remember Independence Day?
I do.
With Suze Kaup and Carol, and I did at South by Southwest in like 2002 or something, or 2003. We had this whole track about early indie web, really, but just like...
It really was, yeah.
But it was, you know, I remember being really upset that people didn't take the web seriously, it seemed, until it wasn't just a bunch of unique publications by individual authors with their own voices, but it became like, here's Entertainment Weekly on the web. And, you know, now you can, you know what I mean? The same old crap on the web. Not that Entertainment Weekly is crap. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying the same old stuff that we can already get at the magazine store is now, you know, and now people are going, oh, wow. Oh, we can put TV on it. Oh, now the web's interesting. Like, it's interesting now because you could put TV on it. You already had TV. And yes, subscribing to Hulu has advantages over subscribing to a cable service, but that's not really the point. The point is there was a whole lot of really interesting independent content in the glory days of blogging. And
yes.
I wonder, I've just gone to work at Automattic, who make WordPress. So again, I believe in the future of that. And I think we're quite capable of having a blogging renaissance, but I don't know that everyone shares that rosy view with me. And I wonder if people just are much happier being consumers than creators. Maybe it's as simple as that. What do you think?
I think it comes down to the same problem that we talked about with the web developers and tool chains, which is that everybody wants more ease of use. Even the all the entertainment uses that you mentioned for the web, on the one hand, it looks like they're just substitute or transferring one entertainment medium to another entertainment medium.
Right.
On the other hand, I do think what we're seeing there is users adopting the things that are easier to use. And we can't really blame them for that. That's
nope.
That's normal self-interest, and I think that makes sense. And the same thing for web developers with tool chains. Hopefully they're adopting them because they find themselves more productive with them. But in both cases, the responsibility is on us. Like in terms of tool chains, the responsibility is on those of us that create frameworks, pattern libraries that we believe are kind of, you know, open web friendly, open web standards compliant, to build those things such that they are easier to use than these existing tool chains. I do believe we can do that.
Yes.
And similarly for websites. So you mentioned all these entertainment sites. You know, why do people, why did people start using all the different social media platforms rather than just like blogs and RSS?
It was easier.
Well, it was easier. And, you know, if you ever tried to keep your RSS reader up to date and like, you know, organize your subscriptions, it's like this huge chore that no one wanted to do. Meanwhile, social media sites made it one click easy to follow people. They gave suggestions for following people. They innovated in user interface and user experience. And that's the, I believe that's the important lesson there.
Yeah.
It's not about entertainment. I think it's about user experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I love Twitter. I have problems with some of the same problems you have and everybody has with some of the leadership and the, what, you know, their kind of cop outs about harassment and speech, but mm-hmm. I love the tool, and I just think it serves I think a blog post is a different thing than a micro. I think when people write 20 tweets and can connect them, that kind of bothers me. I'm like, you know, maybe this would have been a good place to, on yourblog.com, to write this whole thing where I, you know, set it typographically nicely so I could read it, and then use Twitter to just say, hey, come read my blog.
So you're not a fan of the tweet storms?
I think that's forcing Twitter to do what a blog already did very well. And, you know,
have you talked to the people that post them?
I haven't. So I should do that, I suppose. Have you?
I have talked to some of them. Yes.
Do they feel and that they get more traction?
It is fascinating. It's not about traction. They actually enjoy the experience of the structure of being forced to kind of put a thought together, then like put it out there. And then now they have to work on the next thought in that compact form.
It's tightrope
walking. And then put that out there. And then it's something that seems to help with their cognitive process of getting their message out.
I do like that Twitter as a writing tool.
Imagine if you were writing a blog post and like, once you finish with a paragraph, you could no longer edit it. So all you could do is write the next paragraph. I mean, I just made that up, but that's the closest analogy I can think of to what the folks that are tweet storming, as it were, are experiencing.
It's thrill writing.
There's probably an excitement aspect to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, usually in good writing, you need to go back and change your paragraphs. You're like, wow. It took me 7 paragraphs to figure out what I was really saying. Now I'll get rid of those first 6 that sucked because nobody needs to read those. I mean, most of us like editing. Most of us need to edit. But yes, I see that. I do have always loved the discipline. I loved it when it was 140 characters. I thought it made me a better writer. I read a lot of Dashiell Hammett. I used to read a lot of Hemingway. There is something about brevity that's great. One of my favorite A Book Apart writers is Mike from Mule Design Montero, who writes like, you know, these one little gut punch after another after another. Luke Rablewski writes these like little brilliant thoughts one after another. I really like writers that can do that, and they don't actually need Twitter and the apparatus of Twitter to do that. They can actually just do that on the page, and that's great. But I do get what you're saying, so that's interesting, and I've learned something.
I've also seen people use it as a form of drafting. Like they want to get their thoughts out before the thoughts like dissipate or something. And so for them, it's like, I'm going to use this tool of a tweet storm or Twitter as my way of brain dumping kind of rawly what's in my head. And then after they've seen it, they can take that material and then turn it into a cogent blog post if they want to.
Right, right. I do that too, not with tweet storms, but just with a tweet or maybe 2 connected tweets. A lot of times I'll do that and then I'm going to write that later. It's the same way that you write some blog posts and then turn them into an article, or you write some articles and turn them into a book. They're like, it's all like the small things are practice for the big thing. And the discipline of condensing is like, you have a screenplay. If you don't have an elevator pitch, you haven't really done your job. If you can't, you know, otherwise it's like a bunch of characters mope around. It's an art film. Okay. But if it's not an art film where a bunch of characters mope around, then you have to be able to say Wonder Woman saves the planet or whatever. You have to be able to, and I think writing on Twitter is good in that. So again, another reason I really like that tool.
Yeah, there's been a lot of good, there's been a lot of UX innovations from Twitter that are still, frankly, inspiring the independent web. You know, as you pointed out, like that's been an explicit movement since the Independence Day back in 2002. And what I feel like on with indieweb.org is doing my best to rekindle that movement and with a new generation of folks that grew up with social media but are now frustrated with it and frustrated with all the harms associated with it. And they're looking for an alternative, but they don't know what they can do. So whether you just want to get signed up on something like micro.blog or get set up with WordPress or you know, you're a tinkering type and you want to code it yourself, like those are all
right.
Legitimate pathways to get on board. And the community is broad enough for everyone. Like it's definitely an all levels welcome kind of community. It wasn't when we started, because those tools didn't exist. Those services didn't exist. So the first thing that had to happen is enough people that are tinkerers get together to figure out, hey, how do we build these tools
right.
So that even more people have access? And we're now at that point where literally anyone can go to micro.blog, buy their own domain, and they have an independent presence on the web that they can use with the tools that are provided both from micro.blog. And because it supports standards, there's a whole suite of different blogging clients, microblogging clients. There are little clients for like posting what you ate, if that's what you want to post on your site. The other big innovation that's happened is with readers. So now in the last 2 years, we finally have social readers. And I'm distinguishing that from the sort of RSS readers of yore with the fact that if you go to a social media platform or site silo like Twitter or Facebook, there's an expectation that you'll read stuff and then you can immediately interact with it. You can comment on it. You can like it. No RSS reader did that. RSS readers were all one way. Like you sat there, you consumed it, and then you were kind of like done. Maybe you played the silly game of trying to unbold all your folders, which was never very, very satisfying. But that's dead, right? The Google killed it. Their reader, aside from maybe a few journalists or hobbyists, people don't really use those kinds of readers anymore. But they do use their social media interfaces to read. So there's now a whole suite of new readers that allow you to interact with content as you read it, but on the independent web, on the decentralized web.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. And it's all built on a standard called MicroSub.
What's that?
That is a standard for reading clients to interact with a reading server, which then handles all your followings for you. So just like on a social media site, you can follow a bunch of people on a MicroSub server that you have an account. You don't even have to set it up yourself. You can follow a bunch of people's websites. You can follow their accounts on social media. And then you pick whichever MicroSub client that you want to use, and that connects to your server, your reader server, and then it shows you the things you are following, whether it's independent websites, people's social media posts, or whatever, but all in one interface. Like, you don't have to jump between sites to do that.
That's fantastic. And the website, the web page for that is indieweb.org/microsub.
That's the standard. And the web page for the readers is indieweb.org/readers. And I'm just now double checking it to make sure I give you the right one.
Reader, I got it. And you did. And this will all be in the show notes. This is a good place. Look, I could talk to you for weeks, and I love our talks, but we've been on for a while, so this is a good positive place to leave it. We've unearthed some challenges that the standards community has to face in order to get more folks in, you know, into the accessible, semantic, progressively enhanced camp. And we can probably do that with pattern libraries, you know, that we build to take up some of the slack that folks currently use JavaScript-based toolchains for.
We are going to do it. We've done it before, and we're going to do it again.
We've done it before, and we can do it again. That's the theme of this show. Thank you, Tantik.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
And we'll have another...
It's been great being
go
on.
Ahead. Go ahead. Sorry. I just spoke over you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No worries. I just said it's been great being on. It's been great talking with you, as always, and weaving all these different themes together.
I loved it. We'll have you back soon. And thanks, everybody.